it's not entirely gone, but the flame has definitely dwindled. Mm-hmm. When I was 20, I had hope that the guy at the club, their ableism would, you know, eventually they'd grow up. But now that I'm 40 and I'm seeing we're no closer to that, it's like, oh, fuck, well, what's the point of this?
Hello, my name's Kay Anderson, and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode, I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories that they created there, and the people that they used to know. So I know that there is a risk with this show of over-romanticizing queer spaces as these glistening oases of tolerance and acceptance, and that once within those doors, nothing at all can hurt you. But that isn't really the case, is it? Like, despite how wonderful and freeing they can be, and I do believe that they are wonderful and freeing places, they can also be a bit shitty and a bit exclusionary. And I was reminded of that this week when I sat down to talk to Andrew Gerza, who is a disability awareness consultant and activist, as well as being the host of the Disability After Dark podcast. We got up to talk about The Edge, which was a gay bar in Ottawa, Canada, and a place that held so, so much promise to Andrew, but really absolutely failed to deliver on all counts. And we talk about why that was and what happened. But that's a weird way to set it up, because this isn't a depressing, woe is me type of episode at all. And I tell you what, that Andrew is one horny bitch. And he seems to have mastered the art of turning every single conversation into a conversation about blowjobs. So expect lots and lots of talk about penises, expect lots of puerile humor and tittering and giggling, as well as the collective despair that we both feel about mainstream gay culture and how vapid and ridiculous it can be. But I think you might know that that's my opinion already, because I seem to go on a tirade about it every now and then. Why don't we get into the conversation and hear from Andrew himself? So, are you an Ottawanian? Is it Ottawanian? Ottawan?
I haven't lived in Ottawa for a good...
Oh, so you're not an Ottawanian.
10-something years. But I think if I lived there, I'd be an Ottawan.
That's boring. Don't you want to be an Ottawanian?
I like what you said, Ottawanian. Yeah, that's almost better. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so you're not from there then?
No, I'm from just north of Toronto.
So what led you to Ottawa?
School. I went to Carleton U back in 2003 because they had the most accessible campus in the world at the time that offered attendant care. So for anybody who doesn't know, for people who have severe disabilities like I do, you need help with basically every aspect of your day. And for a lot of kids to go to college, it's hard to go to school when you don't have care attached, or you can't afford that, or you can't get a caregiver. So Carleton was the only school in the world at the time, or one of the only schools in the world, that offered care while you lived in residence. So if I got into that school and lived in residence, there would be a team of caregivers who would come when I needed the bathroom, come when I needed to have lunch, come when I needed to whatever kind of help I needed, they would be there. So that kind of led me there. I wasn't ever planning to go there, but then the opportunity arose and I was 19 and I was like, I want to get the fuck away from my family. Yeah, this is a great opportunity, sure.
Mm-hmm. Lots of my episodes, you'll be surprised to hear, start with, I want to get the fuck away from my family.
Yeah, but I love my family. They're great. But when you're 19, you want to just leave your family all the time, so yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. And so what do you remember of your first days in Ottawa?
My first day? it was hard for me to make friends because I know that my public persona is very outgoing and but deep inside I'm a very shy person. I'm super awkward. So making friends was really hard for me. Like, I know how to turn on the charm and do that thing easily, but when I'm by myself alone and no one's around, I'm the most like self-doubting, shy, awkward human in the world.
But there's also something exhausting about turning it on, right? Like, you don't want to have to turn it on all the time. You want to relate to someone on a like person-person level.
Yeah, for sure. And so, but I felt that one of the ways to make it through my first couple of days in Ottawa was to turn on that like cheeky part of myself. So I did that for a while, but that was, as you say, exhausting. And I made friends, not quickly, but I went to all the Frosch events and I went to all the things and I mingled and I made sure I was there and I did like sexy innuendo. When you're 19, you say stupid things about body parts. Did all that.
Oh, give me an example.
Oh, just like, hey, want to touch my joystick? Stuff like that. Silly stuff like that to make people like laugh. And, you know, I'm pretty sure my Frosch name, not from my first year, but from my second year, was like Hobag, because I just would constantly make sexual innuendo and jokes to make people laugh. So that was my first couple years there. And I also I had just come out of the closet about 3 years prior to my family. And so I was like, oh, I'm free to be alone and to like figure out what all that is by myself. Cool. Like, I was so excited because now I could like go to the clubs or go to the campus queer events or go to whatever it was and be like, oh, I can actually be a queer person now. Great. It's not just a label that I'm throwing around.
So let me just ask a follow-up question here.
Yeah.
So you came out a few years earlier to your family, but when you were in like Toronto, when you were in your hometown, did you not then go to any queer type events?
Well, not really, because I was 16 and I was shy and like my hometown was really, I don't want to say it's not super conservative, but there was nothing really queer centric in the early 2000s then. So no, I didn't really go to a lot of queer, and because I was disabled and 16, there was no way I was going to be like, hey mom, take me down to Toronto so I can go to a gay, like that's not happening. So I really didn't have the chance to kind of access my queerness before then, but I could proudly say, hey, I'm gay. And at the time, that's the label I used. So I would say like, hey, I'm gay, I'm super gay, but I could never act on it because of proximity to the queer community and then my age and then my disability and all those things kind of made it hard for me to. And I lived in my family's home, so it wasn't like I could invite a guy over and, you know, test the waters. That was not happening. So when I left for college, it was kind of like, oh, I'm free now. Nobody can tell me no. I can make this decision on my own and I'm going to go try. And my family was very accepting of my queerness, but I wasn't going to like tell them all the things I wanted to do. And now that I was away from them and able to do it, there it was.
What were all the things you wanted to do?
Oh God. I was raised on a steady queer diet of queer as folk and like illicit porn from the early 2000s that just popped up on my computer that I don't know how it got there. Oh no, these two men are fucking.
No idea. Yeah.
Oh goodness. Yeah. So I was raised on a very steady diet of that. And so I wanted I wanted to meet Brian Kinney at the club and I wanted to do all the things that I was seeing the queer archetypes do. And I wanted the quick and easy sex that TV was telling me you're supposed to have. And I wanted, you know, I wanted to have a boyfriend immediately after the first date. And I wanted all these things, which now I realize are like a soapy non-reality, but that's what TV and popular queer media at the time, and still to some extent today, is telling us. And so I longed for that.
Honestly, like all TV should come with a disclaimer at the beginning saying like, this is in no way realistic.
This
do
is not
think
realistic.
This would ever happen in
do
real
not
life.
Do this. Yeah, please don't believe this is real.
Because, TV fucked me up so much. And just as you were saying, I felt like, oh, yeah, so it's going to be easy. I'm going to go out to the club. I'm going to meet someone, fall in love, bing, bang, boom, off we go.
Yeah. And I really had that. I genuinely believed that that's what I would do for years. And I very quickly realized, oh, gay men are don't know how to handle that I'm disabled. What are we, what, why, what? This is a community that's supposed to be love is love. Everybody accepts you, blah, 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 blah. Like, and I very quickly found out the other side of our community, which is like, no, no, it's not. Unless you're white, muscular, and down to fuck, like, you're not accepted.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've talked about your first days in Ottawa and being like excited about being able to explore. Do you remember the first time you went to a queer event or club or?
I remember my first club experience. I went to this club. It's not the main one that I would go to. I can't remember what it was called, but it was some club in Ottawa and it had stairs to get in. So I went there and I took my lesbian friend, and I'd never been to any kind of queer anything before, and I was really excited because it's like, yeah, I'm going to have a queer as folk moment. And this is, it's going to happen. Yep, this is what it's going to be. So I got there and I realized the minute I got there that I couldn't get in. And so this really cute bartender decided it was his mission to lift me up the stairs and put me in a seat and then lift my wheelchair up the stairs and then put me in my wheelchair, which I thought was, at the time I was like, this is brilliant. And so I didn't understand that gay men flirt to say hello. And that's basically like, hi, how are you? So I genuinely thought this person was into me. And so I, you know, and he, and we were flirting all night, which I now realize is just bartender for how are you?
Give me a tip.
Yeah. And so he was flirting. And at the end of the night, he gave me his number. And so I called the number immediately because I was excited. I was like, oh my God, the cute guy that carried me up and down the stairs all night gave me his number. I'm going to phone him immediately to set something up because this is, when will this ever happen again? I better do this. And so I called it and it wasn't his number. It was a pizza place.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So I probably went too far. I relentlessly, when I was 19, I relentlessly called this guy's work. Because I knew, I was like, well, you work at the bar. So I called the work until I finally got a hold of him. And he was like, dude, I was just being nice to you. Like, there was nothing romantic happening there. And 19-year-old me didn't know any better. I was like, well, what? Okay, sure. So I remember that being really hard for me because I was like, oh, this community is supposed to be all about acceptance. And I remember, like, when I was in the club, I would try to dance with a group of guys and they would back away. Or I would, like, try to insert myself in the cliques of gay men to dance or to be part of the community. And they would just kind of look at me with like sad eyes and be like, what do we do? And so at first I was like, oh, that's a one-off. It won't happen again. But the more and more I started going to clubs, and then there was one club that I would go to every week because I was like, I'm going to meet somebody. I'm going to change their minds. They're going to see how hot I am. I'm going to do it. So I would go every week to this club called The Edge in Ottawa, which is like down on the main drag of like the queer part of the city. And so I would go there every week, and this club was not accessible, okay? They were accessible technically, but they had stairs going in and they had an elevator through the garbage chute that I had to traverse my way through. Not the chute,
but through the garbage chute.
Yeah, okay, not the chute. The through the back end of the club.
Oh, okay.
So I had
to
go to the club, find somebody outside the club, get them to tell the bouncer that I was there. The bouncer would have to have a few minutes to get me, come upstairs, bring me around the building, go into this little tiny elevator that would bring me to the club. And so it was not really accessible in any way without all those things were happening. But technically, I could get in the club.
Okay. So then my immediate follow-up question is, why The Edge?
Why that one? That was like, oh, you're looking for a Friday night thing to do and you're queer? Go to this place.
It was just the place then.
I'm sure it wasn't the place, but it was like the one that I knew was accessible and the one that like the college kids would go to and everyone on my campus that I wanted to bone would go there. And so, well, I'll go there too. And like every mid-30s gay dude that 19-year-old me was lusting after would go there. So I would just go there. And once I built a relationship with the bouncer and once they knew me a little bit, they would know that I was coming. And so I was like, okay, well, I can at least get in. I should just go there. And so I remember when I lived in Ottawa, I would go probably when I was younger, probably once every week or once every other week, I would go to just try to, I was like, I'm going to go and meet somebody. I'm going to make out with somebody. I'm going to like bring somebody home. I'm going to do it. Because at that point I was like, all I want to do is fuck. Because I'm 19.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, that's what everyone else is doing. So that's what I want to do. But every time I would go to this bar, every single time I go in there, and they'd always look at me with like sad pity eyes, or they'd look at me like, oh, good for you for being out tonight. Good for you. Is it you, are you enjoying yourself? And they would always treat me like I was not really supposed to be there. So I just kind of was like, oh, this is not really what I want, but also this is where I can connect with my queerness. I better go. But I distinctly remember it being like really hard to engage. And I remember one instance where I went to the club. I'm in the club like usual, and it's drag night, and so the drag queens are doing all their catty stuff, which, you know, we're all supposed to love, but I never did. I was like, you're a bit too into this, like, cutting people down thing. But okay, fine. So we were there, and so we're dancing, and the drag queen taps me on the shoulder, and I thought it was going to be, like, some hot dude being like, hey, you want to dance? And it was the drag queen tapping me on the shoulder to say, somebody reported that they bumped into your wheelchair when they were dancing. Can you get off the dance floor? And I was like, oh. And I was like, I'm just dancing with everybody else. And she was like, yeah, you're kind of in the way, though. Could you just not be on the dance floor? And I was too shy and angry and young to stand up for myself. So I just said, all right, sure. And I left. And I was like, fuck you. I'm not going to worry about this. But I would still go back. I would go back to just, maybe this time it'll be different. Maybe this time they won't be assholes. But I would have people fall over me on their way to the bathroom drunkenly from the bar, and then look at me like I did something wrong because they couldn't coordinate themselves because they were drunk. Mm-mm. And I was like, I'm just here. But I got treated like a piece of furniture when I was there. I never got treated like someone who deserved to be there. I could never actually get... Actually, when I think about that club, I could never actually get on the dance floor. I could get...
like next to the dance floor.
Yeah, there was like a riser, so I could get on the riser and see down on the dance floor, but I could never get in amongst the people to dance. So I always felt excluded. But I was like, maybe one night I'll meet somebody. And there were nights where I met dudes and took them home, and they always ended up being weirdos and never calling me back. And
the universal experience,
yeah, of gay women. Like just the horrible dudes. And I, you know, I'm a hopeless romantic. I'm basically like, Taylor Swift should write songs about me because that's the level of romantic delusion I have. But I'm a hopeless romantic. So, and I would always give people the benefit of the doubt. And so they do something horrible to me, like not call me back or, you know, your typical gay male fare, basically. Mm-hmm. And I would fawn over them because it's like, oh no, they're a good guy, it's fine. And all my friends were like, no, what that person did to you was they were an asshole, like, don't stop butting up with it. But you know, 20 years ago I had hope, which has definitely hardened and crusted over into like rage. Now it's just rage. I just don't have the energy.
Okay, we've gone like in lots of different directions, and I have got lots of follow-up questions, so I might take us back a few steps, but I want to find out about this rage at one point. One thing that I'm really keen to find out about is, you talked about your first time at this other bar with the guy who gave you his phone number. Do you remember your first time at The Edge?
No. It's kind of all a blur of like...
many nights mushed into one.
Yeah. So I imagine like I got there and I realized it wasn't accessible, but then the bouncer told me that there was a back way. Mm-hmm. And I probably was excited that there was a back way, but I can distinctly remember having to wade through boxes and garbage bags to get into the club from where this elevator was. And I distinctly remember being like, well, this is not accessible. But at the time, I was like, whatever, you're leading me to possible dick. I'll, sure, this is no problem. Now I look back at that and I go, why would I ever accept this? This is not accessibility. But then I think about also, like, I think about, you know, so many queer establishments don't have the funding or the money to really even run. So I can't even blame them. They were just trying to keep their doors open, but at the consequence of accessibility.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you said that a lot of people would look at you with sad eyes or be really patronizing when they met you in the club. And this kind of no way of winning when people do that, when they like start off the interaction with this, like establishing this hierarchy between you and them.
Yeah.
How do you respond when people do that? And are there any tips?
Now or then?
Well, both, maybe.
Now it's just, well, I want to say it's rage, but really it's like, you know, I've put myself in a position as a disability consultant to teach people about disability. So now it's like, okay, where does that fear come from? Why do you think it's appropriate to talk down to somebody? Why are you looking at me like I don't matter? What? Tell me why. Let's unpack where this come from. Then I'd just be like, oh, whatever, you're ridiculous, fine. Now I'd be like, let's unpack it, because I don't think queer men, particularly queer men, have any education on what it is to be disabled. And our, you know, in our community, a lot of people, because of AIDS, have seen their partners get sick, have seen their partners die, have seen generations of queer men disappear. And so when they see a disabled person that embodies what they think is sick, they get scared. They don't know why they're scared, but it's scary. And so I think that's why a lot of queer men are so into fitness and health and like all the stuff, because they're afraid of, if I get sick, what would that mean for my viability as a queer person? And so me, I'm like, well, I'm sick and hot. Why can't that be a thing? Like, why is that okay? And I think it just scares them. So now my kind of thing is like, queer men need education on disability, and they need that education in the clubs they go to, not just for me presenting or doing a podcast. They need somebody in the clubs being like, hey, have you ever seen a really hot disabled guy at a club? No? Gee, wonder why? Let's talk about it. Like, let's break it down. Or have you ever seen a really hot disabled guy on the apps and you wanted to talk to them, but you were scared? Let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. They need somebody to like kind of hold their hand through, you've done ableist things, let's explore why, without shaming you. And so I would say to them now, like, you gave me sad eyes, and yeah, that's a little bit ridiculous, but why did you do that? Where did that come from? Let's unpack that together.
But how do you, and this probably speaks more to my pettiness and short fuse than anything else, but how do you, like, how do you manage to always take the high road rather than be like, listen here, you fucking man.
Oh, no, please. Let me be very clear. I 100% do not always take the high road. What I just said was like the perfect version of who I am. The real version is like, fuck you. I mean, I'll give you an example of, and if this person's listening, I'm so sorry, but you did this yourself. So,
no, don't be sorry. Fuck you, person that's listening.
Yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, I had a date with a guy. He was from the UK. I believe where you are right now.
Oh, they're terrible.
Yeah.
Ugh.
He's from the UK, but he's from Canada, but he lives there now. And we met on the apps, and he was visiting town, and we had a chat a little bit on the apps, and he was cute, and I was cute, and we ran into each other, and so he was like, well, let's start chatting. So he gave me his number on WhatsApp, and we were voice chatting and video chatting, and it was fine. And I said to him, you know, I'm really, really disabled. Are you okay with that? Like, do you have any questions? Are you like worried? Any trepidation? He goes, yeah, I have questions, but I think you're hot. Now let's at least go for a coffee and no problem. And maybe if the coffee goes well, we'll fool around. And I was like, cool, great. So there's a coffee shop right across from my house. And so I said, come down to where I am because it's easier for me and we'll have the coffee and whatever. And so from the minute we had the date was fine. We're making flirty jokes. We're talking about what he does and what I do and things are good. And then I said, oh, do you want to come back to my place? Like opening the door for, hey, do you want to fool around now? And he said, sure. So we get back here and he walks in the house and he sees all my equipment, the things that I need to get in and out of bed every day, the things that I need to, just what I need to be a disabled person and live. And I could see the fear in his face come over him, like, oh, wow, this is real. Like, if I fuck this dude right now, I'm going to have to, like, actually care about him when I do it. And he couldn't deal with it. And so then I was still being flirty, and I kind of felt that from him. But I was like, okay, I'm going to keep pushing it forward and see where we go. Then he says to me, well, I don't think we're going to mess around today. I should probably go. And then we made out for a second. So it's like, weird. All right. Okay. And then
well,
he was
after
like,
he said that.
Yeah. So then we made out. And then he was like, I should probably go. And I was like, okay. And then he left. And so I WhatsApped him. And I was like, I hope that went okay. Like, I sensed there was some stuff going on. And he goes, oh, yeah, your needs are just too substantial for me. and it's a lot for me to take in, and I've never been with somebody like you before, and it's a bit scary. And I said, I get that, but you're never going to know until you try, and I can guide you, and it's okay to be scared, but to run out of here because I confronted you with, like, my reality is kind of a cheap shot. And he was like, oh, no, I'm just used to the... what he said, and I'll never forget what he said because it underpins exactly what we've been talking about. He said, oh, I'm just so used to the casual, easy sex that I get to have. And I just said, well, you know, okay. So being with me is hard then. Having to care about somebody and put a little bit more effort in is too hard for you. And so, like, that is the kind of stuff that I encounter, not necessarily at a club, but on the apps or when I go to meet somebody or planning a date or any of that stuff. And so I just have kind of reached this point of, like, I'm not even mad anymore. I'm just over it. I'm just disappointed and over it. Because, like, I don't want to scream at you. I don't want to fight. I tried to educate. Like, I told him he could ask me whatever he wanted. I would answer it. Like, I gave him so many chances to be like, I want to understand this. And then he was like, I got to go. And so he won't be the first and he won't be the last person to do that. But it's exhausting. Like, I'll be 40 in 6 months and I haven't really gone on a second date with somebody that was genuinely wanted to, like, hang out. And so it's exhausting to have to constantly, like, prove that I'm worthy of attention. And then even when I prove that I'm worthy, it's not only that, it's also like, oh, I'm only worthy for you to fuck me and then leave. There's no continuity. And that's not disability per se. That's just being queer. It's being a queer man, period, unfortunately, in the age we live in. So I try not to get angry, but I definitely get angry. It's hard. It's really hard.
Because I think it's that whole thing of that you... Like, people kind of just shut down in these situations, don't they?
They just get scared. And, you know, unfortunately, it's not their fault. It's just because they don't have any education on what it means to be around a disabled person. We don't have comprehensive education on what ableism looks like, what it feels like, how we contribute to it, especially, you know, when it comes to sexuality. And, like, how do you fuck a disabled person that you're interested in? There's no education around that. I don't blame him, but I also think you're a queer man. He was about 50, and I was like, you're a queer man. You've probably been through some discriminatory things. Do you not see how what you're doing is equal to that? Is really similar to that? Like, you must remember being excluded from things because you were queer. How did that feel? And so I feel like our community perpetuates that on a different scale. We all say love is love. And like I said earlier, love is love until you're black, trans, disabled, non-binary, any other kind of combination of those things. Unless you're white, muscled, and have a big dick, you don't belong here. And that's a shame.
Yeah, real shame. But I want to ask a question about you when you were younger, because you said that the response that you had at that point was just like, oh, you're an idiot, and just kind of brushing it off. Was that more a protective response? Or
yeah, I think so.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I have nothing to really add to this conversation other than it feels so unjust because there's not really any response that you can make that doesn't just make them double down.
Yeah. And I mean, again, it was totally okay that he's scared, totally okay that he's uncomfortable, but running away from me because you're so, like, what am I possibly going to do to you other than say, can you help me get in bed? Let's have sex.
And let me show you how to use this equipment.
Yeah, like, that's the end game, is I want to fuck you. Oh, sorry, that's so scary. Like, what? Okay. And so I wish that queer men would... And we're so into club culture, like, still, even in 2023, or app culture, like, quick, easy hooking up, like, and I wish that, and even on the apps, you think the apps might be more accessible. I go on the apps and I get, oh, what happened to you?
What?
Or, oh, does your dick work? Or, oh, like, what does Crip mean? Because my profile on Scruff right now is Big Dick Crip. I have no problem.
Are you saying that so people can look you up?
Sure, you can look me up. Sure. But no, but I'm saying that because I play with the fact that I'm disabled and I make a joke of it. And I play with it in the profile. And so people will say, like, what does Crip mean? And why do you have, what does it mean? Why do you have that in your profile? And it's all, and I have to explain, like, I'm disabled. Here's what the deal is. But I find that because we're so accessible to each other now, we've become less kind to each other. And I feel like as somebody who's marginalized within the margins of queerness as a disabled person, I've borne the brunt of that a lot of the time. And it's really, it can be really, really hard. And so, like, I have resorted to working with sex workers because it's literally easier to pay for what I want than to have to worry about all the bullshit.
Well, that leads me then to the other thing that I wanted to talk to you about. You being a hopeless romantic, those were your words, not mine. and how do you maintain that sense of romanticism?
Oh, it's gone. It's...
Oh?
I wish I could say...
Not even a shred.
No, there's a shred, but I'm just tired. I'm just tired. I keep putting myself out there and I keep trying and I keep bumping up against people's ableism and it just sometimes feels like too much. So I think I posted like the other day on Instagram something like, I think I'm probably going to be single forever, but that's fine. I can have intimacy when I want to. Like, I'm just tired of the way our community chews each other up and spits each other out. And it's just not, because I don't fit the mold of what I don't have an OnlyFans. I'm not, you know, hustling on the side and showing my pole and hole to everyone that will blink. Like, which is fine. And if you're doing that, good for you. But I don't have...
Can I just quickly pick up on you saying pole and hole? I don't think I've ever heard anyone say that. I'm quite impressed.
Really?
You.
Wow. Because I can say it again. Well, yeah, I just think that, you know, with so many people having OnlyFans now, that's basically another gay rite of passage. It's just like, are you doing video content? It's like, okay.
Are you monetizing your body? Yeah.
Yeah. Believe me, if I had more ability level, I would be a fucking OF rock star, okay? I'd kill it. If I had the ability to figure out to do the camera stuff on my own with all my dexterity issues and all the things, I would be killing that market right now. But because I have severe disabilities and can't do it on my own, it's just not viable for me. But also, like...
So should we just say if there are any videographers in
Toronto, yeah, in Toronto who want to hire me or work with me or film with me, I can pay you in love and maybe a couple dollars.
You can work out an income split, right?
Yeah, that's right. Because I know freelancing is hard. But I think with the rise of all these things, it continues to elevate in queer spaces that it's only certain bodies are acceptable. And we see it all the time on those platforms. What do you see mostly? White, muscular dudes who all know each other and have this weird incestuous relationship with one another, filming collabs together over and over again. And after a while, it's like, oh, this is boring because I've seen you all together. And I'm very happy for your, like,
I don't get the thing.
Business plan.
I don't get the thing about OnlyFans, really. Like, I'm one of those people who, once I've watched a porn once, I'm like, okay, I never need to see that again. So I can't imagine, like, following someone and then being interested in all of their videos all the time. Doesn't it just get boring?
As a viewer, and I watch a lot of porn, and I've done a little bit of porn myself, too, but, like, as a viewer of that porn, it is really boring. It's like, okay, I get it. You're all friends. You all know each other. You all, like, visit each other's cities and fuck each other. Great. Why does that need to be content? Why do I have
to
watch it?
Like, it's really off-putting for me to watch a porn where someone is looking at the camera to make sure that the angle is right or whatever.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
It's like, you're not in the moment. You're not enjoying this. Why? Like, how am I supposed to enjoy it?
And I think that translates into how we have sex, too. Like, I was with a guy a couple years ago, and I swear to God, he was making the noises as if there was a camera there. And I wasn't doing anything. And I was like, what are you doing? There's no way I'm pleasuring you that great right now. Please explain to me what camera you're doing this for. We're not filming anything right now. What are you doing? It was so, like, it was so strange. And it just shows that, like, I think these platforms are the monetization of our bodies is really ruining how we engage with each other in intimacy. When I have sex with somebody, like, And I filmed porn. But even when I was doing that, I was like, I want it to be real. I want it to be us just having sex. Can we just, sure, the camera can be on, but can we just fuck, please? And so yeah. My scene partner, who was also my sex worker, was like, sure, we'll just do what we always do. And that was great. And it was a really fun video to shoot because it showed people, like, here's how somebody with severe disabilities fucks. Here's a 22-minute video of how that happens. Watch. And, like, that was really cool. And I even sent it to the guy that I invited for coffee. I was like, look, here's my porn. Watch this. It'll give you a how-to on what to do.
What, before or after you had your coffee?
Oh, no, I sent it before to be like...
So he had all that already.
I think it probably just hit him that it was oh, my God, this is real. This is, like, really real.
Yeah, it is funny, though, how porn just totally warps our expectations of what sex should be and how it could be. I keep getting the feedback that I don't make enough noise.
Oh.
So no one knows if I'm having a good time. And I don't know if that's just because they watch lots of porn and they, like, listen to people making lots of noise. Or maybe I'm not having a good time.
The problem with gay porn noises is this. Gay male porn noises usually are, fuck yeah, bro. Yeah. Like, and it's so boring. It's not creative. It's not actually enjoying. You can tell they're not enjoying what's really happening. They're doing it because they know, they're blowing my dick, so I better act like this is great. Let me say fuck a bunch of times to show my masculinity, to prove that I'm not, like, a sissy queer person, which is ridiculous. And, like, if you want to be more femme, all power to you. But, like, the way that it's packaged in queer media is so mask for mask, bro for bro, like, and that can be exhausting. So even me, like, I notice when I have sex sometimes, I'll say, like, fuck, and I'll be like, ew, I didn't actually mean that. Sorry, let's redo. That's not what I was trying to convey.
Well, what should you say then if it's not fuck?
I mean, I kind of like your approach of just don't say anything. Like, you don't have to make it this big, oh, yeah, like, it doesn't have to be. It can be somewhere in between fuck and that, but somewhere in between those two things.
How about less teeth, please?
But maybe some people like teeth.
Well, okay, maybe.
Yeah. Listen, some pressure on the head of a dick is very nice. Just a little bit, not, I'm not saying bite on it. I'm saying just a little bit of pressure is very nice.
Yeah, I think we have different tastes.
Clearly, that's just fine.
So, hopeless romantic. So you just are letting go of that part of yourself.
As I get older, yeah, I'm just too tired. I don't have the energy, man. I'm just exhausted. Like, I'm not saying that there's a part of me that it won't be there for, but I'm just like, I don't want to try. I've tried. Every time I try, I get bumped by someone's ableism, and I just don't have the energy anymore. Like, if you want to fuck me, you try. Why do I have to do all the work?
But okay, wait. Hopeless romanticism is not about getting buggered.
Really? I mean, have you met most gay men today? Really?
Well, just, you know, it might lead to a bit of buggery, but it's something in and of itself.
Can you have a side podcast called A Bit of Buggery, please? Can we produce that together?
Sure. Yeah, I can do that.
The first episode can be What Sounds Do You Make a Man?
Can be a tutorial for me. I can learn things. But no, hopeless romanticism is here. Oh, this isn't helpful because this is an audio podcast. Hopeless romanticism is a different thing to sex.
Yeah. I love the idea of romance, but also romance for me as a disabled person is really hard because I know they have PIP over there. You're in the UK, right?
PIP.
Personal independence.
Oh, okay, yes, something. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's shit over there too. And if you, in Canada where I am right now, if you move in with a partner or get married, you could lose your whole disability benefit.
Really?
So if I fell in love and let my Taylor Swift moments, like, wash over me and met a guy and we were having this whirlwind romance and he was like, oh, Andrew, I want to move in. And I said yes. And the government found out, my benefits could be slashed.
Because they would assume that your partner would then become your carer.
Yeah. Or would be my financial breadwinner, because if you're on benefits, you must be destitute and completely poor.
Fuck.
So the whole idea of hopeless romanticism is nice, but it's just not a reality for me. So I'm kind of reaching this point where I'm like, I'm just going to be an old fucking spinster. I'm going to just enjoy my life and do my stuff and get dick when I want it. And otherwise, I'm good.
But okay. But that aside, like, yes, that is a practical roadblock. But it doesn't mean that you can't have romance just because you can't live with someone.
Yeah, but because romance is so tied to like different stages, like you meet somebody, then you go on a bunch of dates and you date for a few months or a year or 2 years, then you move in, because it's so tied to like progression. I can't offer somebody the next step. Mm-hmm. I can offer you, come over once a week and we'll fuck, that'll be great. But I can't really offer them what, you know, if they're looking for a relationship, I can't offer you the next step. It's not realistic for me. So I'm not saying I can't play in the world of romance for a little bit. Sure, I can love bomb you all day long, but that's, you know, nobody wants that. And first of all, it's just not realistic. So I haven't given up, but I'm really not wanting to pursue. I want to suck all the dicks in the world. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I want
all
to.
All of them?
A fair amount. And I also want to be with all the hot trans men out there in the world without fetishizing them, just saying that there are some really attractive trans dudes. But that was a long tangent to say it's not entirely gone, but the flame has definitely dwindled. Mm-hmm. When I was 20, I had hope that the guy at the club, their ableism would, you know, eventually they'd grow up. But now that I'm 40 and I'm seeing we're no closer to that, it's like, oh, fuck. Well, what's the point of this?
Mm. And I get, like, where you're coming from. I get what it is you're saying. And I get why the cynicism has encroached your... I don't know where I'm going with the sentence. Well, I get it all.
Encroached my joy, yes.
Encroached your joy. But... it's so sad that we as a society are programmed to think that by the time we get to 40, like, that's it, just give up.
Well, you know, by 30 in gay terms, you're dead. So the fact that I'm even making it to 40, there should be a ceremony of some sort or something. But
No, you know. No. You should be like holding on to like all the things that bring you joy and all the things that are core to your being until you're like 80. But we're all being programmed and having those wonderful elements of us stamped out.
Yeah. I mean, that is true. But like, again, listen, if a Taylor Swift song comes on and there's a dude in the room that I'm into, I'll let the fantasy happen. But I don't know. I've tried. Like this date that I had 2 weeks ago, it threw me so off my kilter. I was like, what the fuck is the point of this? Why am I even putting myself out there? I can get good dick, expensive dick, from sex workers that I pay, which, you know, it's expensive, but I can get exactly what I want and be just as fulfilled and find the joy in my own path. And so... you know, all those experiences in the club years ago kind of primed me for this kind of moment of self-reflection of like, I'm okay to be alone. And I think some queer men are just going to be alone, and there needs to be more stories about that too.
Oh, absolutely. And like, I'm not trying to say like, oh, being alone, oh, that's so sad or anything like that. Like, I think being alone is wonderful. You know, you get to choose what you have for dinner. You get to choose what you watch on TV. Like, there's no arguments about any of that crap.
You can jerk off whenever you want. And you don't have to, you could just, whatever you need to do, you're good.
Always bringing it back to sex, Andrew. Always bringing it back to sex.
You know I run a sex podcast, right? Yeah.
Well, here I am talking about, like, dinner and TV, which maybe, like, lets on to the fact of how boring my life is. Anyway, shall we talk more about the club then? Shall we talk more about
Yeah, we can do that.
So, were there any moments of joy there? Because I don't want this whole conversation for us to be like, wow, isn't life crap?
Were there moments of... I'm sure there were moments of joy. I remember at one point in the club, not so much a joyful moment, but a funny moment. I remember, like, two guys drunkenly fighting over which one of them would take me home. That was fun. I can't remember how old I was or what precipitated them fighting, but I remember taking like bi curious dudes to the corner of the bar and making out with them. Like there were moments of like, yeah, things are okay. And I remember taking one of the newscasters in Ottawa. Like I remember that one night at the end of the club, I was waiting for a cab. And when you're disabled, like me, getting a wheelchair cab at 2 a.m. was impossible. So I was waiting for this cab to come, and he was out there drunkenly with friends. And he clearly had chosen me to like be the one he was going to take home that night. And so he took me with his friends to McDonald's, bought me nuggets, because I guess that was him showing that he was cool or whatever. And then came to my place and we fucked. And I thought it was like, oh yeah, we're gonna see each other again. Oh no, he just wanted to get his rocks off and be done. And then the next night I turned on the news, and guess who's on the 6 o'clock news, anchoring the news? The guy that I just blown the night before.
But you didn't call his workplace, did you?
No, thank goodness. I was smart enough not to do that. No, no. So yeah, there were definitely moments of joy, but they weren't consistent. They were very fleeting. And that very first moment where I went to my very first gay event and the guy gave me his number and then it didn't even turn out to be his number, was like, wow, okay.
Yeah, people are trash.
Trash.
I am kind of impressed that he remembered the phone number for the pizza place, though.
Me too. Maybe he was hungry. He could have been... Maybe he was drinking the product on the job. I don't know.
Like, that's the phone number that comes to your mind. Like, that's... Yeah. It's very telling.
But I remember being so, like, so upset when I dialed the number and it wasn't him. And I was like, what? How can you... Like, you carry me up and down stairs. And I was very naive. And I think I still have some of that naivete mixed in with, like, even though I'm jaded now and I'm definitely becoming Dorothy from the Golden Girls, but even though I'm jaded, I still hope that one day somebody's going to, like, sweep me on my feet and do all these things, but I just, there's a comfortability in knowing that I won't ever really have that. There's also, like, don't have to worry about that bullshit because guys are trash, and, like...
Like a letting go.
Yeah, and so the more and more, like, I'm nearing 40 in about 6 months, and part of me jokingly wants to marry myself because I technically can't marry anyone else or I'll lose my benefits, so might as well have a wedding with myself because I can't marry anyone else. And, like, I just kind of want to just embrace that I'm going to be alone forever, not in a way that's like, oh, I'm so sad I'm going to be alone, but, like, no, you're going to be single. That's all right. There's nothing wrong with that. Find the joy in that.
Mm. Do you have any memories of The Edge, or maybe clubbing from your own queer scene that you want to share? Well, I think you know it's about to come, right? I want to hear all about it, so why not get in touch? My plan is to create the biggest online record of people's memories and stories of queer clubbing, but I can't do that alone, can I? I can't go to every single club in the world, even if they were still open. Anyway, go to lostspacespodcast.com, find the section Share a Lost Space, and then tell me all about what it is you got up to in your queer space of choice. Or if that's a bit too much and you just want to dip your toe in the water, why not get in touch with me on Facebook or Instagram, where my handle is Lost Spaces Pod. Find out more about Andrew by following him on Instagram at AndrewGerza6, visiting his website, AndrewGerza.com, or why not give his podcast, Disability After Dark, a wee listen. If you enjoyed this episode, I would really appreciate if you were able to leave a review on your podcast platform of choice, subscribe, or just tell other people who you think might be interested in giving it a little listen too. My name's Kay Anderson, and you have been listening to Lost Spaces.